thanks so much. It's great to be here with so many friends and see so many familiar faces. And I know on behalf of your folks from around myself, I want to thank everybody for coming, but also for what you do every day. I oftentimes don't get a chance to thank the industry for what you give us, which is our ability to overmatch the enemy. And what we're saying in Future Force Development is we don't want any fair fights. Fair fights in war means fairly winning, and fairly winning at wars is an ugly proposition. And so it's what you do for us that helps give us our differential advantage over our enemies. And what we say in the Army Robbery concept is what gives American Army forces their power is combinations of skilled, well-trained soldiers and teams with technology. That combination is what's really important. So I want to thank all of you. It's a real privilege to be here, especially with my wingman, General Brown. A lot of what I'm going to talk to you about in terms of the Army operating concept we experienced together in Nineveh Province, and we see today in Nineveh Province in terms of the complexity of armed conflict today and in the future as well. So what I thought I'd do is talk to you about two things, really. The first is train for what? Develop, work on human and team optimization for what? And how our Army is thinking about future armed conflict, the demands that's going to place on our force, and then how Army forces have to operate as a result. And then talk to you about how our Army is approaching future force development in a different way. In a way where we can have a really logical trail between our conceptual foundation for Army modernization, how we're going to operate in the future, the development of first order required capabilities, and a framework for analyzing and thinking about future war, how we're going to learn based on that framework, and then apply what we learned to future force development. So I thought if I could introduce those two things, and then see what questions you might have, and so forth. So the first thing I'd like to say is about the Army operating concept. I'd ask you to please take a look at it, read it, give us feedback on it. It's a relatively short document. The purpose of that document is to lay that conceptual foundation for Army modernization. It will drive other strategic documents. It will drive the functional concepts, which are organized around our warfighting functions, fires, intelligence, sustainment, maneuver. But what we're endeavoring to do that's different is we're trying now to force collaboration across those warfighting functions. Because those warfighting functions, as valuable as they are, to look at certain aspects of Army operations in detail, they artificially separate those things which have to be routinely combined in combat and in operations. So the method we're using to do that, to force that collaboration, is the warfighting challenges. And those are the first order required capabilities that have come out of the Army operating concept. They're an Annex B of the Army operating concept, concepts to capabilities that describes how we evolve the Army from today into the Army of the future. And also in there is a technology annex and annex C that describes the technologies we think hold promise for, again, giving us that differential advantage of soldiers and teams with technology. And then finally, the description of risk as an annex there as well. But first, Army operating concept, how did we think about future war and what are the implications for training soldiers and teams? One of the first things we said at the beginning is as we looked at other concept work in the past, where we've gotten ourselves into trouble is when we didn't really consider a combination or balance, really, between continuity and change. The historian Carl Becker said that the memory of the past and the anticipation of the future have to walk hand in hand in a happy way, right? Or else you're going to make poor conclusions about the future. And it's consistent with the way the Greeks said you think about the future, right? You walk backward into it, looking at what you've experienced and looking at what you're experiencing today. So what are the continuities that we consider? We consider four key continuities in war, all of which have an impact on how we train soldiers and leaders and teams. The first of these is obvious one for all of us. War is an extension of politics. So can we conduct military operations to achieve sustainable political outcomes? So what that means is leaders have to understand how their military operations are affecting the overall purpose of the mission. And so this is an important factor in the sorts of environments we create, the scenarios that we create for training. It is what has driven the great work that Tom Greco and the TRADOC G2 team have done in the TBOC, and trying to create these databases and these environments that replicate that kind of political complexity. And when we neglect the need to connect what we're doing militarily to the achievement of outcomes, we oftentimes confuse activity with progress, or we could actually conduct operations in a way that's undermining what we're trying to achieve overall. So how do we create those kind of complex environments? The second continuity that we consider is that war is profoundly human. And what we have to do is we have to create environments in which our soldiers and our leaders and our teams can understand what is really driving the conflict, what is really causing the violence. And so how do we bring into simulations training, how do we bring into all of our training activities the drivers of conflict that have been really the same for like 2,500 years, understanding fear, sense of honor and interest among certain communities. Having that kind of depth in scenarios that allows us to do that. Of course, war is human, and our soldiers and our teams have to operate in environments of complexity, uncertainty, and persistent danger. And so how do we develop really resilient soldiers and cohesive teams and adaptive leaders who can cope with those challenging conditions? And so our simulations and our training, you know, have to thrust our soldiers into those environments and build the kind of resiliency and cohesion that we need and the adaptability within our leaders. This is where we get to environments that can help us, you know, can help us achieve, you know, cognitive dominance, right? Help soldiers feel comfortable in these environments, identify the presence of the extraordinary, the absence of the ordinary. Help our leaders understand how to make decisions, you know, with incomplete information and bad information, and build bad information into our training environments as well, to develop really what psychologists are calling naturalistic decision-making capabilities among our leaders. And then finally, war is a contest of wills, is what we consider, and the need for us to be able to sustain operations over time, and also to recognize how we defeat an enemy, not just physically, but also psychologically. Gaining psychological advantages associated with the tempo of our operations, for example, gaining positions of advantage and achieving surprise. And oftentimes, I think what we've seen in training sometimes is we replicate environments where we reduce war and warfare to a targeting exercise. And that's not that we have to think differently about our enemy and how we defeat our enemy and impose our will on an enemy, but also bolster the will of allies and partners and influence neutrals. So these are some of the implications for continuities in the nature of war. But we also consider changes, right? Changes in the character of warfare. And we looked at really four key areas here as well. The first that we looked at are threats, enemies, and adversaries in the operating environment. And of course, you know, there are a broad range of threats. And you know, we can just look today at North Korea, for example, which I think is a danger that is often underappreciated and undervalued. If we look at what Russia has done on the Eurasian landmass, using combinations of unconventional forces under the cover of conventional forces, and a very sophisticated, you know, hybrid warfare approach to accomplishing their limited objectives by waging limited war in Ukraine, Crimea, and Ukraine, for example, and what they're already apparently initiating to a certain degree in the Balkans. If we look at the catastrophe in the greater Middle East and the situation in portions of Africa, northeast Nigeria, for example, we see, I think, today, harbingers of future conflict. And so what we've concluded is we have to be prepared to fight across a range of military operations against these hybrid enemies, the fielded forces of nation states, but also non-state actors, transnational terrorist organizations that often blend over, bleed over in organized crime networks, non-state actors that enjoy the support of state actors. And now, today, these non-state actors have capabilities previously associated only with the fielded forces of nation states. So as we watch trends, as we look at capabilities of enemy organizations, we can't just watch the most industrialized places in the world and say, how do we develop our capabilities to defeat them? We have to look at the least industrialized places in the world oftentimes, and the kind of capabilities associated with these non-state actors, or these hybrid organizations. And so for us, what that means is we have to think about enemy organizations of different types, hybrid enemy organizations, and how to defeat them effectively. So we have to think in particular in terms of the interaction with the enemy, the
the interaction with the enemy over time in the conduct of operations, recognizing that we have to fight hard to seize, retain, and exploit the initiative, that we don't just, we can't just, you know, be dominant. In previous concept work, a lot of times the word dominant was all through it. What we're saying now is we have to fight hard over time to seize, retain, and exploit the initiative over an enemy that's going to take unexpected actions and unexpected initiatives against us. So this is an important element of the concept, and we're considering really four things we have to show our enemies doing in training so that we our leaders are prepared to fight against these kind of organizations. No longer thinking, you know, after phase three or so-called phase three, right, defeat the enemy, and then you're done, right? Leave on an up note. You know, the torch just stands up across the combat. You can't do that. You've got to be able to consolidate gains as you're going. Continue to seize, retain, and exploit the initiative. So what are the four things our enemies are doing? We have to keep taking consideration. We have to replicate and train. The first thing is they're going to evade what they see as our strengths. Remember back in the 1990s, we said, okay, we're going to have dominant battlespace knowledge, and therefore we're going to be able to make perfect decisions based on those perfect decisions and perfect plans, right? We're going to be able to defeat the enemy from staying off range. Remember the layered onion approach to protection, right? I mean, what we recognize today is the enemy is going to evade our network strike, long-range strike capabilities. And so evading is what we have to consider for these enemy organizations and then what we do based on them evading it. All sorts of implications for our force. For example, what that means is we have to conduct reconnaissance in close contact with the enemy and civilian populations. These enemies, you know, they're not targets. First of all, sometimes they number in the tens of thousands, and all of them are trying to avoid being classified as a target. So dispersion, concealment, intermingling with civilian populations, and deception. We have to consider this interaction with the enemy and the need to develop that situation actively and to be able to conduct reconnaissance, for example, by stealth, but also to fight for information, you know, in close contact with that enemy and, again, with civilian populations. The second thing our enemies are going to do is disrupt our capabilities. So the capabilities that we bank on, right, you know, reliable communications, the ability to move data to the forward edge of the battlefield and so forth, I mean, are we going to be able to rely on that, do you think? We don't think so. We think that we see sophisticated cyber attacks we have to replicate in these environments, electronic warfare capabilities oriented on us. And by the way, some of the capabilities we're developing make us more vulnerable, not less vulnerable to those sort of enemy capabilities. So what we need is the ability to fight degraded. Our formations have to gracefully degrade, not fail catastrophically. And that's a material aspect of that, but it's a cognitive aspect of that. And it's a doctrinal aspect of that in terms of mission command. The need for decentralized operations based on mission orders will be greater, we think, in the future. The other thing our enemies will do is emulate our capabilities. So we tend to think sometimes we're going to make linear progress. Remember, we're going to have leap-ahead capabilities. Here we are. We're going to leap ahead here. No peer competitors. Lock the enemy out of the market of future conflict. All that heuristic language of the 90s. Well, we interact with enemies in war, but we also interact with adversaries in between wars. So if we go for a differential advantage on a narrow suite of capabilities, high-end technological capabilities, we're just about guaranteeing that those capabilities will be largely relevant to the outcome of the next war. So what we're saying is because our enemies will be able to incorporate those kind of capabilities, we get our differential advantage from multiple technologies that we use in combination with each other. Combined arms operations, what we're talking about now, joint combined arms operations to pose the enemy with multiple dilemmas. Long-range precision fires capabilities, we think we have to certainly worry about the enemies in the future, combined with weapons of mass destruction, combined with sophisticated anti-tank capabilities, combined with, you know, with what we've seen as really our advantages in the air domain, right? Especially with the proliferation of UAVs and UASs and so forth. So we're going to see a more rapid migration of our capabilities to our enemy. And the final thing our enemies are going to do is expand onto other battlegrounds. The battlegrounds of social media, information operations, and communications. The battleground of political subversion, the battleground of organized crime. So we have to, our forces have to operate on all these battlegrounds. Oftentimes, Army forces are in a supporting role there, But we have to operate effectively against the enemy across all contested spaces and battlegrounds, and our training has to replicate that. So that's the first thing, is the enemy. And this is how we see the enemy in broad terms changing, and, you know, Tom, is that all right? Terry? Okay. All right, so the two guys are over there. I want to make sure I'm good with them. So, and they've done great work, by the way, on our operating fire. Everything's super work by our intel team. So threats, enemies, and adversaries. The second thing are missions. What missions are we going to have in the future that we're going to have to conduct in those areas? What we said is we have to get to prepare our forces across a range of military operations to prevent, shape, and win. So to prevent operations, we need forces that, you know, that are regionally aligned, rotational, but also forward position, that can reassure allies, that can deter conflict. We think that in the future, to deter against an adversary who's going to wage limited war for limited objectives, this is forward deterrence. How do we deploy rapidly with capable teams to ratchet up the price of aggressive action, for example, in a Crimea-type scenario? For shaping security environments, we're saying in the future, I mean, we can't imagine a scenario, right, where we're not going to work with multinational partners. So we have to work with these multiple partners, but we also have to understand where our interests align or don't align with theirs. And when we replicate that in training, we have to make it clear that oftentimes our interests are not congruent. And our leaders are going to have to do what negotiation and mediation theory calls for, and do some interest mapping and see to what degree they're going to have to exert influence on those actors to either alter their behavior or convince them that it's in their interest to act with us. I mean, think about Iraq. Think about our security force assistance effort with the Ministry of Interior, largely captured by Shiite Islamist militias and the Iranians. Think about Afghanistan, where we're working with security forces that are subverted by criminalized patronage networks that are hollowing out the institutions and the capabilities we're trying to build. Think about the Malian army, who we train, and then a large percentage of them defect and fight for al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. Think about the Nigerians, who could deal with that problem, except their leaders are mainly interested in filling their own pockets. So we can't assume that whoever we're working with is going to be a reliable agent for us, right? This is what political scientists call principal agent theory. So missions that we're going to conduct are going to be in complex environments. We're going to have partners with different levels of reliability, and we have to prepare for that. And then what other missions? Well, we believe that in future operations against these enemies that are taking these actions, joint operations are more important than ever. American military power is joint power, and that's how we pose multiple dilemmas to the enemy. So our training has got to replicate joint capabilities. Our leaders and our units have to be able to understand capabilities and limitations of joint capabilities and integrate them into our fights. And we say that the way we're going to have to operate in the future to deal with this kind of capable enemy is we're going to have to deploy rapidly and then transition quickly into operations. This is what we're calling expeditionary maneuver. An expeditionary maneuver, it's not just getting there, right? I mean, you can get there fast, but unless you're getting there to reenact World War I, you better come with mobile protected firepower. You better come with combined arms capabilities and access to joint. And so what we're saying is we need to deploy rapidly teams that have the appropriate combinations of mobility, protection, lethality, combinations combined with joint capabilities to accomplish missions. And what we're trying to do is to deploy it into unexpected locations and then to transition into offensive operations in many of these scenarios to deal with some of these threats. So what we're saying, forces in the future, what do they have to do? They've got to be able to fight effectively while widely dispersed in smaller combined arms teams. But they have to do that while maintaining mutual support, right? We don't want to create multiple little bighorns simultaneously across a big area. That's not success. So our forces have to be able to see and fight across wider areas. They've got to have the mobility to rapidly concentrate against dangers or unexpected opportunities. Think about elevating the tactics of infiltration to the operational level, right? Think about Napoleon's own campaign, or the Ludendorff offensive, except for this work. So this is the kind of thing we're thinking about, and we're calling it expeditionary maneuver, which is not just getting there, but it's getting there with forces of sufficient scale and for ample duration to accomplish the mission. And then of course, it's a joint combined arms operations, as we discussed in the operating concept. Now, this places huge demands on sustainment. We think one of the disadvantages of many of our simulations is, they make it too easy on us.
right? You know, amateurs disregard logistics, right? Real professionals think about logistics integrated in everything. And we've got to do that.
The other key thing in terms of how we want to fight in the future is every formation we think should be three-dimensional. Everything is an air-ground team. And again, this is all going back toward the operating concept, posing multiple dilemmas to the enemy. So missions, how we're going to conduct those missions. Some of the things we want to replicate that I think are particularly important is enemy long-range ballistic missile capabilities, so-called A2AD capabilities, but more than that, right? Offensive long-range ballistic missile capabilities with maybe weapons of mass destruction. Think V1 and V2 threat to London in World War II.
Think Scud missile threat in 1991 to Israel. Think rocket threat to Israel in 2006 out of southern Lebanon, or just last year out of Gaza. So our forces have to operate as joint teams to deploy rapidly, conduct reconnaissance to confirm or deny the presence of that kind of capability, conduct offensive operations to defeat it, transition to area security operations to deny territories used to the enemy, and then what we're saying in the future is American Army forces have to be able to project power from land outward into the air, space, maritime, and cyber domains. So missions is the second key thing. So as enemy, we think it is changing significantly. Missions for the future. The third is technology. And these are technologies that will enable our force, but also considering enemy technological countermeasures and enemy technological initiatives. And so what are some of the things we're focused on? Obviously, it's autonomous and semi-autonomous systems. We think that's from tremendous potential. We're also looking at technologies that increase the lethality for our forces. We're looking at lighter weight materials and so forth that enable expeditionary maneuver, power and energy, you know, technologies that will allow us to sustain high tempo operations at the end of extended and contested lines of communication in austere environments. And we're also looking for technologies that can simplify, you know, our network and our communications capabilities that can make it less fragile, less complicated, and more resilient, and allow it to degrade gracefully if it comes under enemy action. So these are some of the technologies, but we're looking at what are enemy countermeasures to all of those technologies as well, and what are enemy technological initiatives, some of which I mentioned in the discussion of enemy. And then the fourth thing, which we often neglect, is history and lessons learned. And this is where I think, you know, our training can benefit tremendously, you know, from experiences we've had in recent years that I think are very maybe similar or analogous to experiences we're going to have in the future. We've had experiences across the full range of combat operations. In particular, I think combined arms operations in urban environments against capable and elusive enemies that's a particularly informative scenario and also recent experience. What the TBOC has done, the Training Brain Operations Center, to capture those experiences, the ability to access those quickly, to bring in those historical experiences and lessons learned into simulation and into training, we think is really important. So I've got like a couple minutes left. So that's how we're thinking about future war. The concept itself really calls, again, to keep the theme of force, that future forces have to be capable of operating with multiple partners. All right, so we want our training to be accessible to our allies and partners, and we want to be able to work on interoperability in all of our training. The second thing is that we need to provide multiple options to the National Command Authority, the Joint Force Commanders. The Army's not a boutique force, right? I mean, we can't go back to the old days. Let's just focus on, you know, phase three against, you know, fielded enemy forces. And then remember, you know, situational understanding came mainly from seeing yourself, seeing the enemy in the terrain. We know it's much more complex than that. So we have to provide multiple options across a range of military operations. We want to pose the enemy with multiple dilemmas. We want to do that in large measure through expeditionary maneuver and joint combined arms operations as defined in the Army operating concept. And operate on all battlegrounds, as I mentioned, and consolidating gains and so forth. And finally, we have to operate across multiple domains. And that's, again, projecting power outward from land into those other domains. Ultimately, you know, we're very concerned, as we should be, with A2AD and cyber and everything else. All those problems originate on land. They all emanate outward from land. So the solution, ultimately, if you're going to compel an outcome, is on land. And we have to prepare our forces to do that as part of the joint force. Okay, so based on this idealized vision of future war, how our army is going to operate, how are we going to build the concepts and capabilities? And so
Remember combat developments, and many of you have lived this year. One of the things is, right, if you're in combat developments and you don't have a gap, you're nobody, right? So what you do is you got to write up your capability gap. Now you have a gap, you're somebody in combat developments. And then if you get, you get a solution approved, and then you get a requirement approved, and then a program record, now you're really somebody. But it's really hard a lot of times in our Army to see how all the aggregate of this chasing of gaps is getting us a better Army in the future. So what we want is a logical trail, right? A logical trail from our concept that gives us a framework, and that's the Army warfighting challenges. Those are the 20 first order questions, the answers to which will improve current and future force combat effectiveness. We need your help in meeting those warfighting challenges. And the process that CAC has laid out to feed into that, CAC is the lead, obviously, for training. So your interaction with them will help us. It will help us with the warfighting challenges. And then we have to learn. And we're learning under Force 2025 maneuvers. Now, Force 2025 maneuvers is the umbrella term for all of our learning activities. That's experimentation, it's wargaming, but it's what Army's doing every day. It's specific pathways exercises, what JMRC is doing with interoperability, it's 82nd Airborne's initiatives with Expeditionary Mission Command, it's 1st Armored Division's prototyping of tactical command posting, and we're going to need to evolve those. It's what we're doing every day. With CTCs, it's what we're doing in Afghanistan today, it's what we're doing in Iraq today, it's what we're doing in Jordan, it's what we're doing in Liberia. We're learning from everything. Our capstone exercise for this is the Army Warfighting Assessment, which will happen under the direction of John Charlton, who's here. John, if you raise your hand, any questions about that? And that's a huge payoff exercise right across, and John will be able to talk more about that on a panel. But then we've got to implement what we learn, right? And this is where we have problems a lot of times. And learning obviously includes research and development as well and everything. So what we're doing is we want to learn in a focused, sustained, and collaborative manner. We want to learn collaboratively. We don't want to go to the next experiment, learn the same stuff again, put it in a white line or put it on a shelf. So how do we do that? The way we do that is through the warfighting challenges. Everything that we're learning is organized into the framework of the warfighting challenges. We have an estimate for how well we can accomplish that warfighting challenge. For example, how do you develop and sustain a high degree of situational understanding in complex environments against adaptive enemies? Okay, that's going to be an enduring challenge. But what can we do across DOPPL, doctor organization training, leader development, material solutions, personnel, policy, and facilities? How do we come up with solutions to that problem based on our projection into the future, thinking about those four key areas? And then we develop these integrated solutions. And then it will be material and other portions of those solutions that will come out of that. And that's what will inform Army documents and processes. And we're going to drive it into there because we've got great partnerships with the Army staff, and all the Army leaders are working together now around this framework of the warfighting challenges. And so the idea is that's what influences the Army plans, what influences the POM and the LIRA and the planning guidance and so forth. So that's the idea. So I just wanted to talk about these two things as a scene setter, how we're thinking about future war, some of the highlights about how we're thinking about it, and what the implications are for training in particular, and then what our process is to go from concepts to capabilities, do it in a logical way. So if there's a training requirement here, a very specific training requirement, we ought to be able to trace it back to a solution that's integrated DOPPL-PF, trace it back to a gap, trace that gap back to a first order required capability of a warfighting challenge, and then trace it back to the required concept work. That's the idea. And I think I maxed out my time, man. Like, General's always good when we have time for questions, man.
No, there's plenty of time for that, sir.
Okay, all right, I'll turn it over to you.
All right, sir.
I'm happy to hear where you'd like to take the discussion. You're stuck with me on a panel here later as well. But thank you.
All right, sir. Are you taking me?